Welcome for Computer Graphics. We looked into transformations last week, and in fact, we slowly started going from 2D to 3D. So we were again looking at homogeneous coordinates, which in fact for 3D transformations are 4D coordinates, and we looked at different types of transformations in 3D, which was pretty simple. So most transformations like translation or skewing and stuff like that directly transforms from 2D to 3D, but probably more interesting are rotations because the space of rotations is very different in 3D than it's in 2D. In 2D, essentially, we only have one possible rotation axis, so a rotation is described by a single axis, which is very simple to write down. But in 3D, it's more complicated because the space is three-dimensional. We need three values, three angles to describe rotations. And we were looking into, for instance, Euler angles, which is to describe an arbitrary rotation in 3D by rotating first around the x-axis, then around the y-axis, and then around the z-axis, which is a rather often used way to describe rotations or pose in 3D. But it has practical problems, and a much more practical but more abstract and maybe more difficult to understand way are quaternions. And so the idea of quaternions is that it's four-dimensional points. In fact, it's like complex numbers, but the imaginary part is three-dimensional. And we've seen, or I've explained, that any rotation can be described by such a quaternion using this operation here. So if we want to rotate a vector v, we transform it to a quaternion by making v the imaginary part and setting the real part to zero, and then computing that product. And q is the quaternion that describes the rotation. So we multiply q with this new vector and then multiply with q inverse. And this gives us, again, a vector with a zero in the real part, and the imaginary part now is a rotated version of v. And yeah, this can be used to describe rotations. For this, we need the product operator on quaternions, which we defined here, and we need a normalization or an inverse that we've also defined before. And yeah, this allows us to describe rotations. But you may ask, okay, rotations are three-dimensional. These objects here, these quaternions, are four-dimensional, so how does that work? The reason is very simple. Quaternions, or the rotation described by a quaternion, does not change when we scale the quaternion. So we can scale it with an arbitrary value, and you can see it a little bit here. If we scale the quaternion, then here, because we also multiply with the inverse, yeah, this scaling factor just cancels out again. So we can scale that quaternion with an arbitrary value, and the rotation it describes doesn't change. So to account for that, we simply only look at unit quaternions. That means quaternions with length 1. And this is still not unique then, because then q and minus q describe the same rotation. But otherwise, the mapping is unique. Yeah, and now we have that four-dimensional space. Yeah, quickly imagine the four-dimensional space and a sphere in that space. Yeah, and quaternions are the points on this sphere. And so this is the space of rotations which we work in. And this space works very well. And in particular, it allows us to interpolate rotations pretty well. So we can now take two quaternions, ideally unit quaternions, and directly interpolate these, and this gives a very smooth interpolation between two rotations. Yeah, so it gives a very natural way that objects move, for instance, from one pose to another. There is one thing that we still have to consider, And that is when we interpolate, we want to interpolate these quaternions on the sphere. Yeah, because I said we usually only look at unit quaternions. And if we now make a linear interpolation, the points in between are not on the sphere anymore. In general, this is not a problem because, also non-unit quaternions correctly describe a rotation, so that's not a big deal. But it gives us a problem that I've also described before. If we look at that example, so let's say these are two quaternions, Q1 and Q2. Imagine these are vectors in 4D space. And now we make a linear interpolation. And what happens now is that if the vectors are pretty far apart, and we have a interpolation with uniform speed here, what will happen is that in the beginning, if we always renormalize the interpolated quaternions in between so that we are back on the sphere, we can see that even if we have a uniform speed here on the sphere, we have a non-uniform speed. And it will be rather faster in the beginning and then get slower and then become faster again. And this is also a little bit visible, so that the movement is not really uniform. And to avoid that, we have to really interpolate or should really interpolate on the sphere. We should interpolate two vectors, Q1 and Q2, so that all in-between points are on the sphere and that we have a uniform velocity or speed on the sphere. And this is a well-known problem. It's called spherical interpolation. So if you want to interpolate two unit vectors or two points on a sphere, we can use spherical interpolation or spherical linear interpolation, often called SLURP. That's even available in many libraries. And the idea essentially is that instead of using such a parameter t to interpolate between start and end point, we use that formula here. And you see that that's simply how it translates this t to vectors, to weights that directly work on Q1 and Q2. And it can be derived that this results in a uniform interpolation on the sphere. Okay, so that's a rather simple problem that's solvable. And then we have a very nice solution to describe this. Okay, good. But for now we are essentially we are not that far yet. Because we've now seen, we can describe all these affine stuff not only in 2D but also in 3D. We can rotate objects, we can scale and transform and so on. We still haven't really looked at the problem. When we generate an image of our 3D world, we first have to project that 3D world to a 2D image. We have to do what normally a camera does. And how does that work? And this is what we will look into today. How do we map our 3D world to 2D? And in fact, we will see that affine transformations are not sufficient for that. We need something more complicated than affine. A very simple example is that if you make a perspective image of a cube, for instance, it will look like this. Oops. And obviously, that means a square is mapped to here to an arbitrary quadrilateral. This cannot be described by an affine mapping. Affine mappings map parallel lines to parallel lines. So these lines in the original are parallel, but in the image they are not parallel anymore. So affine mappings are obviously not sufficient. So we need something, a larger class of transformations. And in fact, we still have a degree of freedom that we didn't use yet. In our matrices that we used for homogeneous coordinates, We always in these matrices also had the bottom row. And we were always using 0, 0, 1 there, which meant that if we have homogeneous coordinates, yeah, and we multiply it with a point, x, y, z, 1, in the result, there will again be a 1 here in the homogeneous component. Yeah, so this gives a closed class of transformations, which are the affine transformations, but maybe we can use that bottom row, and in fact we will, and this will give us a new larger class of transformations, which are projective transformations. Okay, and how does that work? Well, we learned that the last coordinate, yeah, the homogeneous coordinate W, to get rid of that, we divide x and y by this value w. And because in our examples it was always 1, yeah, this was just throwing that coordinate away, w. Yeah, so we didn't really care about it. But in fact, the w is a kind of common denominator for all the coordinates. Yeah, and how it is computed, we can describe by that matrix. So we can generate a denominator that is not constant, but that also depends on x and y and z. Yeah? So if we use these three values, we can generate a common denominator using x, y, and z. Yeah? So transformation looks like that. We take, in our example for now, a 2D point. We make it homogeneous. Then we multiply a matrix, and now we multiply an arbitrary matrix. So we get a W, which can be an arbitrary value depending on x and y and the 1. And then for dehomogenization, we divide by this w prime here. And if we write that down and if we have a 3D matrix that looks like that, we get this formula here. So this is the simple product of x, y, and 1 with the first line of the matrix. This is the product of this with the second line. And the product with the third line is this new common denominator. Yeah? So now we have a division. So you see this product depends on x, y, and on x and y. Okay, that's a very abstract introduction, but we will see in examples that this is exactly what we will need to describe perspective. Yeah? So with that, we arrive at a new class of transformations, which we call, or which are called projective transformations. And now our matrix in general looks like that. Yeah, we here always have a linear part. That's simply a matrix that is multiplied with our normal coordinates, x, y, and x, y, z. We have the translation. Yeah, and this is how we introduced homogeneous coordinates. We said it's if we use them, we can here simply also write down a translation and get a translation with a matrix multiplication. And yeah, sort of as a side product, we also have this bottom line here for which we can also choose the values or apply arbitrary values now, and this gives us the class of projective transformation. So if here A and B are not zero, but something else, yeah, then we have a projective transformation. Okay, let's see how the resulting images or what these transformations look like, yeah, to get a feeling for it. So let's, for instance, look at this matrix here. Yeah, so here the bottom line now is 0, 1, 2. I mean, it's not randomly chosen, yeah? But it's not affine anymore. Yeah? So here this 1 makes it a non-affine matrix. So what does it map values to? Yeah? The value 1, 1 now is mapped to 1, 3rd, 1, 3rd. Minus 1, 1 is mapped to this. Minus 1, minus 1 to this. And 1, minus 1 to this. And these are the corners, the vertices of a unit triangle. Unit square. Yeah, and obviously the unit square now is mapped to this shape here. Yeah, 1, 1 is mapped to 1, 3rd, 1, 3rd. That's this point. this is mapped to minus one-third, one-third, and these are mapped to themselves. So, one could say this square, is mapped to this. It's not a square anymore. It's an arbitrary quadrilateral. So these points remain, and these are mapped to here. We can, just to see how that works, we take the matrix 1, 0, 0, 0, 1, 0, 0, 1, 2. Let's multiply it with one vertex with 1, 1. We set the W component to 1, homogeneous coordinates. The result is, we make the product 1 plus 1. So here we also have a 1. And here in the bottom we have 1 plus 2 is 3. And this now is the common denominator. So if we go to 2D, this gives us 1/3, 1/3. And if you take the same rules for the other vertices, you will get exactly this shape. So now we have a mapping that transforms here, the square, to this here. And I mean, maybe I'm doing that business too long, but when I look at that, I immediately see a perspective image of a rectangle, right? And this is exactly what we will need to generate such images like the perspective cube. Okay, but we are not that far yet. So obviously, this is a rather interesting class of transformations. And now you might say, okay, I only transform the vertices, but is it really true that also the edges remain lines? It could also be that it makes generate something curved or so. And in fact, this is not the case. Such projective transformations always map lines to lines. So straight lines or line segments remain line segments. There's one exception, but in general, lines remain lines. This is what we can say. And this is one property, but in fact, other things are not maintained, as for affine. So parallel lines do not remain parallel. Obviously here, these edges, here they are parallel, and here in that image, they are not parallel anymore. And also ratios are not preserved. Maybe you remember for affine transformations, I said, if I take a line and its midpoint in the image, the midpoint is obviously on the line and it's still the midpoint, but now it's no longer the case. This midpoint is mapped to here. So here it's just in between the two, or just at the middle, which is here no longer the case. So also ratios are not preserved. So an interesting new class of transformations, and maybe also to get a feeling of what these transformations do, one can also show that for each, for now, convex quadrilateral, there is a unique projective transformation that maps the unit square to the quadrilateral. That means with such a mapping, I can take an arbitrary quadrilateral like this, for instance, and now define a projective mapping that maps the unit square to this quadrilateral. So we can squeeze that square into that arbitrary quadrilateral, and I can show that with a little demo. Here we can see it. So what we see here on the left is a unit square subdivided into little squares. So it's a grid on the unit square. And on the right, we see an arbitrary quadrilateral in the beginning, again, a square. So that's very simple. But I can take now these corner points and move them. And in the background, there's always this projective mapping here is computed. Yeah, a 4x4 matrix that maps these points to these points that I can choose. And then in between, yeah, we use that to map the entire grid from here to here. And yeah, again, I think the thing on the right really looks like a perspective view onto that, right? And yeah, we can move it around as we wish. Yeah, and maybe we can also try to generate something non-convex. Now something weird happens, but in fact, it's still a valid mapping. Okay. Yeah, so that's another way to look at projective mappings. Yeah, it maps the unit square to an arbitrary quadrilateral. Okay, so a new class of transformations. And now you might say, okay, in that example, I said it maps lines to lines, but parallel lines don't remain parallel. What does that mean? Essentially, it means that here in this image, I must get an intersection between this line and this line. Yeah, somewhere here, these two lines will intersect. Yeah, but in the origin, these lines don't intersect. Yeah, so is there a contradiction? And in fact, it's not. The point is that such projective mappings can map points from infinity to finite points and vice versa. So if we look at that example and we take these two parallel lines here, yeah, that don't intersect, or the other interpretation, they only intersect at infinity. Yeah, if we take these two lines and map them here with this perspective, with this projective mapping, these two parallel lines intersect at this point. And in fact, in the original, yeah, here, this is a point at infinity with, now with this mapping, is mapped to a finite point. Yeah, and if you remember from last time, points at infinity or directions, we can represent by points with a homogeneous coordinate zero. Yeah, if we now take an arbitrary matrix, it's no problem at all. It can take a point at infinity with W zero and map it to something with W not equal to zero. Yeah, so a point at infinity becomes a finite point, and also vice versa, a finite point can become a point at infinity. Yeah. So maybe that's maybe at first sight a little bit weird, but on the other hand, it's exactly what we need for perspective. Yeah. If you remember these two rails from a railroad, yeah, in our image, they converge in a vanishing point, yeah? And this is a point in our image, yeah? But in fact, it's a point at infinity, yeah? At infinity, these rails converge, yeah? But they converge in our image at a finite point. And this is exactly what happens here, yeah? If these are our two rails, yeah? In our image, yeah? They converge here at a finite point at the horizon, yeah? The horizon is infinity. Infinity becomes visible. Okay, good. So, how does that help us? Yeah, I already said, if we look at the typical image of a cube, yeah, we get maybe something like this here, or the one like the one I've drawn. And now if we say, okay, the sides of the cube are a square, so the image of this side of this face is again a square. That's okay. That can be represented by an affine matrix. But this here, yeah, obviously is not affine, yeah, because these parallel lines are no longer parallel. So to get such an image, yeah, affine matrices are not sufficient, but projective mappings will be will do the job. We can get something like perspective of that form here, And that's if in school you learn perspective, the first way to show perspective is what is called parallel perspective. And here, parallel perspective is a kind of approximation of real perspective where parallel lines remain parallel. So the lines that go away from the viewer, yeah, these lines still remain parallel. And so the side face here becomes such a parallelogram, and this can be described by an affine mapping. Yeah? But probably at school you also learned that this is not a real perspective. It can be used for technical drawings because this has nice properties, but it has the disadvantage, for instance, that it doesn't generate a perspective in the sense that objects that are further away become smaller. Yeah, so you cannot, yeah, with the distance, the size of objects doesn't change, which is unnatural. Yeah. And to get that, you need something like a real perspective, and this cannot be described by affine mappings anymore. Okay, so that's an interesting observation. And just as a little side remark, you don't need to read this entire text, or you can read it at home if you wish. In fact, now we have a kind of hierarchy of transformations. So when we introduced these transformations, yeah, we started with rigid transformations. These are transformations where we only translate and rotate. And then we also added scaling. Yeah, and then we were in the transformations, in the similarity transformations. We then added these arbitrary affine matrices, which gave us affine geometry or affine transformations. And finally, now today, yeah, we are looking into these projective transformations, yeah, where we use homogeneous coordinates and the full matrix, and see that now we get a new, even larger class of transformations. And in fact, this is one of the major observations that Felix Klein made. And he made it in his work, which the nice thing, yeah, he called Erlanger Programm. And in fact, he was a professor here in Erlangen, a mathematician. And he found that hierarchy of transformations in some sense. So here you can read a description, yeah, about different transformations, yeah. And if you look, for instance, here at the last paragraph, finally, I mean, sorry, it's in German, yeah, but if we finally also add infinite points as the intersections of parallels, yeah, so in that case, we end up in a new class of transformations, and he calls this projective geometry or projective transformations. Yeah. Okay, so Erlangen has a direct relation a very strong relation with these hierarchies of geometries. And in fact, some of you also probably know the Klein bottle. Who knows the Klein bottle? None. A few. Okay. So this is a screenshot from Futurama, yeah, a joke in the background. Yeah, so here on a shelf you can see such bottles here. These are so-called Klein bottles. It's a shape with a very special or very special shape that has no inside and no outside. This has also been first described by Felix Klein, and in fact, even that one is relevant for computer graphics, and we will come back to that in a later lecture. This is also a relation to computer graphics. Okay. So, and the building where our chair, for instance, is the Felix Klein building. Yeah. So it's a cool relation, I think. Good. So that's what I originally planned to also explain in the last lecture. And so today, okay, you see something, I don't. No, it's the other way around. Juhu. Okay, so yeah, now we have all the tools to really describe that mapping from our 3D world to a 2D perspective image. And in fact, we only have to bring together all that stuff now. Okay, mapping from 3D to 2D. Yeah, in computer graphics, usually, I mean, unless we do simple 2D computer graphics for simple diagrams or so, yeah, but the interesting thing is to map a 3D world to a 2D image. And in fact, there are two questions which we have to handle for that. The first one is, how do we map a 3D point of the world to a 2D point in the image? This is what we will learn today. And the next is, how do we determine occlusion? Yeah, because if we map 3D things to 2D, obviously closer objects hide those further away, and we also have to handle that. Yeah, information can get lost. Yeah, a complete 3D world, when projected to 2D, of course, yeah, many things get lost simply because they are occluded. So we will do that on Thursday. Today we only look at how to map 3D objects to 2D, and to get rid or to avoid that occlusion problem, we will always look at simple wireframe cubes, yeah, where no occlusion happens, because these wires are so thin that they don't really occlude each other. But we will look at really filled objects then on Thursday. So, okay, how can we do this mapping? Probably the simplest approach to map 3D objects to 2D would be the following, and this is not the real solution yet, would be the following. We take a 3D object, and we take our 2D image plane, yeah? And now we simply take a projection direction, which we here call D, and now we project each point, yeah, along this direction D onto the image plane. Yeah, so we generate a ray from this vertex in direction D, and where this ray intersects our image plane, yeah, here we draw our vertex. Yeah, and now we have lots of lines. 12 lines, I think, that compose this cube, and we project each line and we get this image. In fact, yeah, here all these lines in the back are missing. Yeah, so here we already do have occlusion, but okay, it doesn't matter for now. Good, that would be a simple projection. Yeah, and we can describe that very easily. We can do it this way. We say we take an arbitrary point x, y, z, and then we add a multiple of vector d, d is this direction, yeah, plus alpha d. Alpha is an unknown multiple. And the result is a point x prime, y prime, 0, where in our case the image plane is the xy plane, yeah? And it has z equals 0, yeah? And x prime and y prime are the image points. Yeah? These are the points on the plane, on the 2D plane. Okay, and how can we compute that now? And first of all, we have to compute that alpha, and that's pretty simple, because if we look at the last component, we directly get an equation for alpha. Yeah, because z plus alpha times the d component, so this is a 3D vector also, d, yeah? Z plus alpha d z equals 0, and from this we can directly compute alpha. Yeah, alpha is that value here, yeah, z is the z, and d z is the z component of the projection direction. And if we plug that alpha in here, we get a simple equation, or simple equations that we can directly express with this matrix here. Yeah. So this matrix here describes exactly this mapping, and you see the matrix is a low rank matrix, so it only has rank 2 here. The last column is 0, 0, 0. This is because all the image points lie at z equals 0. Yeah. So yeah, we really squeeze the 3D object from 3D to the 2D image plane. Yeah, this is why, or this can be seen here, the last row. So this is not, we don't use homogeneous coordinates here, by the way. Yeah, this is without homogeneous coordinates up to now. Yeah, okay, and obviously we can describe that by a single matrix, yeah, so it's an affine mapping. And in fact, this is exactly the parallel perspective that I've described before. Yeah, so it generates something like this here. And you see the sides of the cube are still parallel, yeah? And this is a parallel perspective or an orthographic projection. Yeah, that's the more scientific way to describe that. Okay, yeah, so this is not the solution yet. In fact, what we will need in the end is another type of projection, and this is a point projection. So here we project it with parallel lines, but in fact, what we will need for a real perspective is that we don't project with parallel lines, but we project towards a center. And the center point, in fact, is the camera, the eye, the position where the observer is. And to get our final image, yeah, we need to project these vertices towards such a camera. And this gives us an image like this here. And now this is a real perspective projection. Yeah? Okay. Good, so we will come back to that in a minute, yeah? But let's first of all still look at this one, because in fact we are not really done yet, because to get our final image, we still have the problem. So now we projected everything onto our image plane, but now we still have to define which rectangular window of our image plane is the final image. I mean, that's rather simple. Yeah, we can take this part, or we could maybe move the image a little bit more to the left, or we can even rotate. Yeah, so that's in the end just again a simple transformation from the image plane to our image space. Yeah, but that's rather simple. Yeah, so this matrix only maps from 3D, the infinite 3D space, to our infinite image space, and then we have to say, okay, this rectangular window of our image, this is the final, of our image plane, this is the final image. Okay, and this we can interpret differently. Yeah, this entire mapping process, and in fact, that's maybe a more, or better to understand, way to describe these mappings. What we could say is the following. Let's say for projecting for doing this again, orthographic projection. Yeah. So we are still in the parallel perspective world. We do the following. We take arbitrary vectors E1, E2, and E3 that are an orthonormal coordinate system. Yeah. So they are all perpendicular. Okay, they are orthogonal, so they don't need to have length 1. And E1 and E2 span our image plane. Yeah, so we don't have, or we have an arbitrary image plane now, not only the XY plane, an arbitrary image plane. And we always project along direction E3. Yeah, and E3 is perpendicular to E1 and E2, and we will see that, is enough. okay, and now projection, or now this E1, E2, and E3, they define a box. Yeah, E1 and E2 do not only span the image plane, but they also span the image. Yeah, so this side of the box is this rectangle on the image plane. Yeah, this gray thing here. This is the rectangle that defines our image, and now the projection simply means project all points in direction E3 onto the image plane. Okay, so here, because it's difficult to visualize it differently here, the image is on this side, but you can also imagine that it's directly here on this side. It's exactly the same projection that you get here or here. Yeah, so we project or we define our parallel camera by simply spanning such a box in 3D space. And within this box, projecting everything, along the third axis of this box to the front side of that box. And now you might say, okay, But before here, we had our projection direction D here, yeah, which has a strong impact on the result, was not perpendicular to the image plane, but in fact, it's rather simple to show that even if our image plane is not perpendicular, you can describe it by such a mapping, and the only difference is a non-uniform scaling in the final image. Yeah, so you can transfer one to another. Yeah, but this one here is rather intuitive because it directly says, okay, I have this box here in 3D space, and everything within this box now is mapped to this image plane here, and everything outside this box, yeah, is not in the image. It's just not visible. Okay, yeah, and this is why it's called orthographic projection also, yeah, because we take this orthogonal box, yeah, spawned by these orthogonal vectors, and within this box, everything is mapped to our image here, yeah, with image coordinates. Here in that example between 0 and 1, but you know in OpenGL, for instance, we always go from minus 1 to 1, yeah, so we can extend that, and then we get directly image coordinates, yeah, by simply projecting along this axis. Okay, and how can we describe that mathematically? Very simple. Yeah, what we do is that we simply take these vectors E1, E2, and E3, and we interpret, or we map object points with respect to this coordinate system. Yeah, so we map it to a coordinate to such a coordinate system where this point is at -1, -1, -1, and this point is at 1, 1, 1. Yeah, that's just a change of coordinate systems. And you know, changing coordinate systems is an affine mapping. We know how to do that. Yeah, we spoke about that when we introduced affine mappings. Yeah, so just mapping this box here to this unit cube gives us this here. Yeah, so this box inside now becomes here such a squeezed box, because usually E3 is much longer than E1 and E2. Yeah, things in this direction are squeezed, but now we have something very simple, yeah, because in that setup, projection now simply means projecting along the set axis. So from each of these points, the x and y coordinate can be seen as the image points, yeah, the image coordinates, and the set coordinate still tells us something about the depth. It's not the original depth value, yeah, but points small set means close to the camera, and large set means far away. So we still can use that set later on to compute occlusion, which we will need on Thursday. Yeah. So yeah, we simply take that box and squeeze it to the unit square, to the unit cube, and then x and y are directly our image coordinates, and set, we will maintain it, we will keep it, because we still want to have that information how far objects are away, so that we can compute occlusion. Yeah, and these depth values are also normalized in the range from -1 to 1. So that's very simple. Yeah, orthographic projection, we define a box in 3D space, map this to the unit cube, and essentially we are done. We have image coordinates and we have depth. Yeah, and we can also look at that. Oh, no, we don't need that. Yeah. Here in a simple demo. So what we see here is again a cube in 3D, yeah, as wireframe. And here with a blue outline, this is a sort of visualization of our image plane. Yeah, it's the window on our image plane that is our final image. And you see parallel projection simply means all the vertices are projected here perpendicular onto the image plane. And yeah, because here we have exactly this configuration, this is the resulting image. Yeah, here this vertex and this vertex, they end up on top of each other. So we get a simple square as a result, but we can change the projection direction like this. Yeah, and now we get such a perspective which you probably expect. Yeah, here you can see the result, and this is the resulting image. This is exactly this blue, the image in that blue square, and you see we get such a perspective image. Okay, and in fact, I mean, this is not shown in this demo here, but in fact, yeah, we could also get this image by defining such a box, yeah, around our 3D cube, and simply in this box projecting onto the front face of that box. This would essentially generate exactly the same result. Okay, so this is how parallel perspective works, and just as a kind of preview, we can here also switch to real perspective. And how does that work now? Now you see here, we have behind our image plane, here we have a point, a center of projection. And this is, in fact, this is exactly the position where our camera will be in the end. And now we don't make a parallel projection, but we project the vertices towards this point. And as a result, we get this image here on the right. Yeah, and this is how a perspective image works, and we can now also rotate our object. Yeah, and you see, this is exactly how a perspective image looks like. Yeah. Okay, but we will come back to that again later on. Yeah. Good. So. Also, to how does that work in practice now? This such a projection. I always speak about matrices, yeah, and this has a very good reason. I told you that we describe all these transformations using matrices because it's very convenient. We can multiply these matrices together to a single matrix, and thus do all that transformation stuff ideally by just a single matrix. Yeah, and we will see that in fact we will define several matrices, yeah, and to make things efficient we multiply all these matrices together to a single matrix, and in the end we have a single matrix that directly maps a point from 3D to a point in our image, yeah, and by a simple matrix vector multiplication we can transform an arbitrary 3D point to our image. And yeah, this usually happens exactly in the vertex shader. The vertex shader is the shader that connects from 3D to 2D. It takes a point from 3D, yeah, a point of our 3D object, and maps it to 2D. And from there on, it's given to the rasterizer. The rasterizer works in 2D, yeah, it does a 2D rasterization. Yeah, and from then on, we are in 2D in some sense. Yeah. And this can be seen here for that very simple example. It's exactly the, or at least from here, it's exactly the same code that you know from the WebGL demo, yeah, all that stuff for setting up attributes and so forth. So we don't care about that. But now our input is a little bit different. We don't have 2D vertices now, but now we have 3D vertices. You can see that here in the V array. Yeah, these are all 3D vertices, and in fact, it's exactly the 3D vertices of a cube. Yeah, minus one, minus one, minus one. This is the lower left bottom corner. Yeah, and this is the upper right top corner, one, one, one. And these are all the other combinations. Yeah, all the eight vertices of a cube. And yeah, because we don't look at occlusion yet. Yeah, I said we look at a wireframe model, so our render primitive now are not triangles but lines, and so our index set doesn't contain groups of three vertices describing a triangle but pairs of indices that describe lines. So our cube consists of a line from vertex 0 to 1, 0 to 2, 0 to 4, and so forth. Yeah, so these are the indices the lines that make the edges of that cube. Okay, and if we render that, yeah, we get this result, and the reason that we get already a perspective mapping is that here we set up a matrix. And in that example, we define a projection direction, yeah, point 2, point 3, point 8, oh, sorry. Point 2, point 3, point 8, yeah, this is the projection direction. You remember the slide where I introduced that parallel projection. And this is the matrix that is also on that slide. Now it's a 4x4 matrix, yeah, because we always work with homogeneous coordinates. Yeah. So here we have this 4x4 matrix. Yeah, but it's the 3x3 matrix and zeros and so forth added. Yeah, so we simply extension from to homogeneous coordinates. Okay, so we take that matrix, and in fact, what we also do is that here we compute a new matrix M, which first takes this matrix and also scales the result by 0.5, yeah, because our image coordinates in the end go from minus 1 to 1, and the cube also goes from minus 1 to 1. We would get a too large image. So we scale the entire cube by 0.5 and then project. Remember the order. This matrix here is first applied because it sees the vertices first. Yeah, we always multiply vertices from the right. So this one sees the coordinates first. So first the points are scaled, yeah, so that we have a unit cube from minus 1/2 to plus 1/2. And then it's projected with this matrix. Yeah, so this matrix now defines our mapping from 3D to 2D. Yeah, handmade. Yeah, so, and in the end, we set this matrix here with this additional code as a uniform. This is a way, yeah, so that we can transport information to the vertex shader. Yeah, so with this, this matrix now is passed to the vertex shader. And the vertex shader looks like this. It has now this matrix M, yeah, as a uniform. Uniform are values, they're kind of constants, yeah, that can be set by the main application quickly. And the vertex shader can now use this matrix M, and it takes the position as an attribute. Yeah, we learned about all that. The position now is a 3D vector because it's a 3D point. And our program now takes this position, makes it homogeneous by adding a 1 as a fourth component, and then multiplies that with M. And that's all. Yeah. So now with before a vertex is rasterized, it is just sent through that matrix that we defined before. Yeah. And this is the result that we've seen here. Now we can change things. Yeah, we could, for instance, change here the direction, the projection direction. Yeah, so let's make this, for instance, change this to a minus. Yeah, and then you see now it's the view direction in some sense changes. Yeah, or we can, yeah, let's say let's make these two smaller. Yeah, then we get this result here, or we can make it larger. Then we get something like this, yeah? Or we could also play around a little bit now and not only scale here, but also apply rotations, for instance, to our cube before we render it. So we can, for instance, rotate around the y-axis, yeah? So we get a rotation in this. So we rotate around Y by 30 degrees. Oop. Okay, I forgot the Y. Okay, that looks a little bit weird. Yeah. maybe we should. Yeah. So you can play around now. Yeah, and experiment. And see the different results, and you see that this is not a real perspective. Yeah, it always looks a little bit wrong. Yeah, and it doesn't look like a cube anymore, for instance. Yeah, but it's parallel perspective. Yeah, it's a parallel projection, and It's all defined by this matrix. You see it is still affine. Yeah? And you see that it is that these matrices that define our camera, our mapping from 3D to 2D, are described by such a matrix which is passed to the vertex shader. And the vertex shader sort of is completely agnostic how that projection looks like. Yeah? It just takes a matrix and applies that matrix to all the vertices before passing them to the rasterizer. Yeah, so it's everything is just stored in that simple matrix, and that matrix completely controls how our 3D world is mapped to 2D. Okay. Good. So, I think I turn on the light again. wake up. good. So that was parallel, yeah? And now the interesting question is, couldn't we also do that with a real perspective, yeah? And in fact, we can, and I already said so. Now we have to define our projection differently, and we don't have to use parallel projection, but project towards a camera, yeah? And towards a camera center, and this gives us such images here. And yeah, this is a rather old observation, but yeah, on the other hand, it took surprisingly long, I think, to understand how real perspective works. Yeah, so if you look at very, very old drawings, for instance, yeah, you realize that obviously they didn't know how to do perspective, how to transform that correctly. And so here are old images, yeah, where people try to illustrate the idea. So this maybe is a very, very good way to illustrate perspective. The idea is the following, essentially. Imagine, yeah, I have this 3D lecture hall and I want to generate an image. So what I could do is that I take a glass plate and I hold it in front of mine. And then I mark every dot on this glass plate. I take paint and I mark it exactly with a color I see through that point. Yeah, and in the end, the glass plate won't be transparent anymore. It will be full of paint, opaque, and I can take it away and I have an image. Yeah, that's a very natural way to generate an image, and this is illustrated here. Yeah, take a kind of picture plane that can be a glass plate or something virtual. And then if I stand here, yeah, directly compute the intersection of a point here with that virtual image plane, and this is where I draw that point in my image. Yeah, very simple. Here are other images, yeah, of Dürer, well known here. Maybe I turn off the light again so you can recognize it better. Der Zeichner der Laute, so what they do here is that the image plane is a grid of threads that sort of define a coordinate system, yeah? And the eye is defined here by a hook at the wall, and then a wire from an arbitrary point that should be pictured, yeah? This wire to that hook intersects this coordinate grid at some point, yeah, and using this wire, these coordinates are determined, and then at exactly the same position, a dot is painted here on the canvas. Yeah, I mean, that's very painful and will take ages, yeah, but you get a perspectively correct image. Yeah, here is an alternative, yeah, with a different object, yeah, and this is how you can draw an image of a person. And it's exactly the same principle. And it's also the principle, or the same principle can be recognized if you look at the first cameras that have been built. And in fact, camera, yeah, comes from the Italian word camera, or Latin word camera, which simply means room. And the first camera was simply a closed room. Yeah, completely dark, no opening, and only one tiny hole in one of the walls. Yeah, and this is the only place where light can come in. And if you have a very bright scene outside now here, what happens is that light goes through this small hole and generates an image here on the opposite wall. And this is an image of the outside world. It's just upside down. Yeah, because those rays or light coming from here is here at the bottom and so forth. But this is again such an image. Yeah. And I mean, for symmetry reasons, I think it's clear that if we take that wall and put it here, we get exactly the same image, but no longer upside down. And then we have exactly the same mapping as here. Yeah, it's just if you would extend these rays and make an image plane here, you have this geometry, but it's exactly the same like making the image plane here and getting a non-upside down image. Yeah, it's always the same idea. It's always a point projection. And yeah, so this is one observation, and this can simply or easily now be used to generate good perspective. Yeah, and one main observation of these perspective images is that we have something like vanishing points. Yeah, you remember these railroads. Yeah. And now, of course, also points at infinity can be mapped using something like this. Yeah, so you go towards the end of that railroad, so to say. Yeah, and it's mapped to a finite point here. And so parallel lines will converge in one single point, and this can be used to generate single perspectives. Yeah, so that we use things like this here. But now we say these parallel lines don't remain parallel, but they converge in one point. Yeah, those lines that go to the back. And this is a one-point perspective, which we can see here. So vertical lines remain vertical, horizontal lines remain horizontal, and those that go to the back converge in a point at the horizon. Yeah, so this is what is called one-point perspective. But there are also others. Yeah, so this is another typical example for a one-point perspective or here. But it's also possible to define two-point perspectives. Now here things are a little bit rotated. Yeah, so now points in this direction converge here, and in this direction converge here, and vertical lines remain parallel. Yeah. So that's a two-point perspective. Here, real-world images. By the way, that's the Felix Klein building about 10 years ago. Okay, there are also three-point perspectives. Okay, but these are not really rules yet or matrices, yeah, that we can use to generate such perspective images. But how can we derive now real formulas to describe that? And you will see that this is surprisingly simple. So whereas in the orthographic projection, we did the following. Yeah, we said we have our object, and now we take parallel lanes, rays, and project onto our image plane. Now for perspective, we project towards the center. And we also saw that we can describe this by simply taking a box, defining a box, yeah, and saying everything in this box is mapped, yeah, in parallel to the to one side onto the side face of this box. What we can do now is that we define a truncated or a pyramid that has its tip in the viewer, and we truncate this pyramid in an image plane, yeah, and now we take this infinite pyramid and we project points towards the tip of the pyramid, and the image is now here on this truncated side here. And this type of object here is called a frustum. And so this shape here, this pyramid, is called the view frustum. And here it's a view box, yeah? And this is a frustum. And Yeah, now we project every point to here. And how can we describe this projection mathematically? For the general case, this is not so simple, but let's look at a very special case. And in fact, from this very special case, we can derive all interesting cases. Let's look at this case. We have our projection center in the origin. Yeah? So first of all, we apply some transformation so that our eye, our camera, is in the origin. And we also assume that we look into Z direction. Yeah? Our camera we look into Z direction. Yeah, this is our view direction. So our image plane, yeah, can be defined, for instance, by Z equals to 1. Yeah, so that's 1 unit away. Yeah, so I'm here, my eye is in the origin. Okay, my eye is in the origin. I look into negative Z direction, and at Z equals 1 is the image plane. Yeah, this is where I hold the glass plate. Okay, and now I have an arbitrary point X, Y, Z, and I project it here onto the glass plate, and because the origin, the projection center, is here, yeah, this projection here is very simple. I only have to multiply this point with some alpha so that we are here on this plane. Yeah, projection just means multiplying that point with some value, usually smaller than 1, so it ends up here on the plane. And this can be computed quite easily. Yeah, so we say alpha times x, y, z should be x prime, y prime, 1. Yeah, because 1 means it's on the image plane. And so alpha times z equals 1. If we look at the bottom row here, yeah, alpha times z equals 1. So that means alpha is 1 over z. And if we plug that in here again, we come to the formula x prime, y prime, z prime is x over z, y over z, 1. Yeah? It's very simple. You can also take similar triangles or whatsoever. Yeah? Believe me, if you do it correctly, you always end up in that very simple formula. So point projection just means, in that case, divide by z. Yeah? Just take your x and y coordinate and divide it by z. And then you get perspective. And that also explains why more distance object becomes smaller, yeah? Because if z becomes large, yeah, then you divide by a larger value. That's okay. Sorry. That means, yeah, that the further away an object is, the smaller it gets. And that can be very easily shown. And the nice thing is, yeah, we can also describe that very easily using such a projective mapping. What we can do is the following. We take a point x, y. Yeah? Okay, no. Let's go to 3D. We take our 3D point x, y, z. We make it homogeneous. And now we apply a matrix so that this z here goes to the homogeneous part, to the homogeneous component. Yeah? So we need a matrix that from this homogeneous point generates this homogeneous point. And if we then dehomogenize, we divide x by z, we divide y by z, and z over z becomes 1. This is exactly what we wanted to have. Yeah? And now we only have to define the matrix that does this mapping, and that's very simple. It's this matrix here. Yeah? And you see it's not affine, because here now we have a 1. Yeah? So it's a projective mapping, but this is a matrix, yeah, that exactly describes this mapping here. Or this mapping here, if this is the origin and this is the z axis. Yeah? Very simple. Yeah, and now we brought all that stuff together. Yeah? Now we have a perspective mapping. We can describe it using homogeneous coordinates and a very simple matrix to describe that. Yeah? Okay. Good. So that's the general idea. Yeah. And now we have to look into how to do that in a practical manner. I mean, We have now here only a very simple case. Yeah, I is in the origin, and we look into the z direction. Yeah, so that's all very special cases. But in fact, we want to do that in a more practical way. So if you think in a computer graphics application, now we have 3D objects. And what our goal now is that we want to describe or generate an image of that world for an arbitrary camera. Yeah, for a user standing at an arbitrary position. Yeah. And so that means, for instance, we need to be able to position our virtual camera somewhere in space. And it's not only the position, we also have to define the view direction, for instance. We have to define the rotation of the camera. Yeah, that also has to be defined. And we have to somehow define how our camera works. Does it have a tele lens? Does it have a wide angle lens? Yeah, that's also one such parameter. Okay, and to make that easier to understand, we separate this image projection into two steps. The first one is viewing, and the second one is projection. And we can, maybe we can see that here pretty well. I said, okay, this is a very special case for our projection. Here we assume that the camera is in the origin, and that we look along the negative, that we look along z direction. Yeah, and in fact, the viewing, yeah, we have these two steps. Viewing, first of all, takes our entire scene and transforms it such that we are in a coordinate system that exactly looks like this. Yeah, so we take the entire world and then we apply a rigid transformation. That means we rotate and we translate it. Yeah, so that the camera is in the origin and that the view direction is the z-axis. Yeah, this can be done by a rigid transformation. It requires a translation. The translation just moves the world so that the origin is in the eye, and then it rotates it such that we look along the negative, because that will come later, so that we will look into z-direction. That's viewing. And from then on, we are exactly in the setup. Yeah. And now we can use that very simple projection. Yeah. Because now we have exactly that setup and can essentially take exactly that matrix, or we will still modify it for good reasons. Yeah. But can then take the simple matrix to generate perspective. And, you also know, yeah, that we can concatenate all these transformations by simply multiplying the matrices together. Yeah, so now we define separate steps. Every step becomes a matrix, and we multiply together all these matrices. And in the end, we have a matrix that generates perspective. And that is, yeah, one single matrix that we can apply in a vertex shader. Okay, so first viewing, then projection. The viewing defines the camera position and the view direction. Yeah, it is a rigid transformation. It moves the camera to the origin and aligns the axis. Yeah, we will see that in a minute. And then we apply the projection. And in fact, for the projection now, we can even choose between perspective and the orthogonal projection. So in this step, when we are here, yeah, we can apply both. We can also still do orthogonal projections. Yeah, orthogonal projections are still used in some cases for constructions, for instance, yeah. Technical drawings, often these people are used to use parallel projection. But we can also apply here the perspective projections, yeah. So it's a separation of concerns, it's different things. Yeah, first of all, where's the camera and where are we looking at? And then do we use perspective projection or parallel projection? Okay, let's look at the different parts. So first of all, viewing. Viewing is a rigid transformation that translates our world or transforms our world to the coordinate system that is relative to our camera. So what we want to have in the end is our world in a coordinate system that looks like this. We have our camera. We have our view direction. This should be the set axis. And we have two other vectors. And in fact, yeah, this is what I want to have. The set axis should be the view direction. And around the view direction, I can still rotate the other two axes, right? But we typically wanted to have it in a way that the x-axis goes to the right and the y-axis goes up. Yeah, this is the coordinate system we are used to. X goes to the right, y goes up. Yeah, that's how you know coordinate systems from school. Yeah, so this axis should become the x-axis, we call it u, and this should become the y-axis v. Yeah, now we have to find these vectors u, v, w, and we know from lectures from last week or the week before, yeah, if we have these three vectors, how can we transform between or to this new coordinate system? Yeah, then it's, if we have these vectors, it's rather simple to generate these matrices. Okay, so how do we define u, v, and w? I mean, w is very simple because w is the view direction, and typically we define our viewing matrix by specifying the camera position. So where is the user that looks into the scene? And the gaze direction, that's the view direction. Yeah, in which direction does the user look into? Yeah, what's the view direction? So we know the camera position, yeah, and we know the gaze direction. And now W is clear. W is just the gaze direction. Maybe we normalize G, yeah, if it's not normalized yet, but W is G, yeah. And now we need to find two perpendicular vectors to G, and we still have that degree of freedom that we can rotate arbitrarily, yeah, and yeah, like you have for a camera. At a certain position and view direction, you can still rotate. But yeah, what do you do? Normally, you hold a camera such that the horizon is horizontal. Yeah, that's why it's called horizon, because it's horizontal. And so what we could do is that we sort of define the horizon, yeah, and say that this should be parallel to the x-axis in the image. But yeah, for some reasons, probably mostly historic, it's not the horizon that we define, but we define typically an up vector, which is here called t. And we say this is the up direction, and in our image, this should point in y direction. Yeah, so the image of that up vector should point upwards in our image. Yeah, so we have that up vector, yeah, and now we rotate such that, from my point of view, these are on top of each other. Yeah, this fixates this rotation direction. And by rotating this up vector, we can then rotate the camera. Yeah? But this up vector is used to fixate that final degree of freedom. Okay, and how does that entire thing work now? So we have G given the gaze direction. We have T given the up vector. And now, first of all, we say W equals to G. And now we have another practical problem. And this is the following. People are usually used to use right-handed coordinate systems. Yeah? That means your thumb, that's a coordinate system where your thumb goes into y direction, the pointing finger goes into y direction, and the middle finger into z direction. Yeah? Now if I apply that to my setup, you see that the z axis goes into the wrong direction. Yeah? Now one possibility would be that I rotate like this, but that means now that x goes to the left, which is very unintuitive. I could also use a coordinate system like this, which is very uncomfortable, and it would swap x and y, which is also inconvenient. So there are two ways out. Yeah, some libraries say, okay, we take a left-handed coordinate system. Yeah, others say, I prefer right-handed. But now I say that the view direction is the negative z-axis. Yeah, this is the convention that is usually used in OpenGL. So we do not use the setup I've shown here, but the view direction is the negative z axis. Yeah, this means that at rather random places, minuses show up. Yeah. but yeah, okay. Some price has to be paid. Okay, so yeah, we say simply, first of all, W is the negative gaze direction. Yeah, so we don't generate this coordinate system, in fact, or yeah, we do. But in fact, no, we don't, sorry, generate this coordinate system, but W should go into this direction. Yeah, so that it's right-handed, like this. Okay, then we want to define the up, the vector that goes upwards, yeah, because this is sort of fixed with the up direction, but we cannot directly take t because our v vector should be perpendicular to the gaze direction, yeah. And if my camera looks like this, horizontal, and this is the up vector, I could directly use it, but okay, maybe from that direction. But if I look upwards, yeah, this is my gaze direction, and the up vector still goes into this, so I should move it into this direction somehow, yeah, so that here we have a, so that here it's perpendicular. Okay, how can we do that? We can simply do that by ignoring V for the moment and first computing U, because we know that U should be perpendicular to W and to V. And we can also say it should not be only perpendicular to V, but also to our up vector. Yeah, and now we can compute U by taking the cross product between T and W. This gives us a vector which is perpendicular on the gaze direction and on T. And if we know U and W, we can compute V, yeah, as the cross product of U and V, U and W. So we first compute the x-axis, yeah, which should be perpendicular to both T and G, and from that we can compute V, yeah, which is then clearly defined or uniquely defined. Okay, so this gives us rather simple formulas, yeah, for a setup like this, gaze direction, up vector, are defined. From this we can compute U, V, and W, and the camera position is the translation that we want to have, and from that we can build up our matrix that transforms the entire world into our coordinate system relative to the camera. That means, in fact, we don't move the camera through the scene, but we move the scene around our camera, yeah, which is indistinguishable, and in the end generates exactly what we want to have. Okay, and yeah, so here the recipe, yeah, compute W, then compute U, compute V, and from this we can build the rotation matrix as we learned before, and we have to invert this matrix, but since it's orthogonal, or yeah, it's an orthogonal matrix, we can simply use the transpose and then simply end up in this here. So this expression we had on one slide before when we spoke about affine transformations and their inversion. Okay, and you see it's affine, yeah? And it's a rather simple matrix, can be quickly computed. So this is viewing, yeah? How can we position our camera and change the angle? Yeah, so now we always have a setup like this. Yeah, we have x goes to the right, y goes up, relative to the camera, and we look into negative z direction. And now we want to do the projection, yeah? And now we can either do perspective projection, or in almost all cases we will do this, or we can even do also do an orthogonal projection, yeah? And always for this particular setup, yeah, that x and y are here, this define the image plane, yeah, so our box now here for the orthogonal projection is defined by just, yeah, this window on the xy plane, and the extension in this direction is always the negative z axis, yeah, so that's very simple. And for the perspective projection, our view frustum, now here not view box, but view frustum will always look like this. So here it also has a back face. In fact, we will usually also define a back face, which is sort of sounds stupid. Yeah, because I mean, yeah, it's not that sight ends at a certain distance. But yeah, we will come back to that later, why it makes sense to also introduce that. Okay, and now let's look at these two projections now. And in fact, this one we already derived. You saw it's a very simple matrix. And here we can also derive that very quickly, yeah? Because you see in that setup, if we have a point x, y, z, projecting it here onto this plane simply means set to zero. Yeah, because our projection direction is just the z axis. Yeah, we can simply take a point in this coordinate system and x and y components, yeah, of that point are directly the coordinates on the image plane. Yeah, it couldn't be simpler, in fact. Yeah, and the matrix looks like this. So you see it's a diagonal matrix, but just here for the identity matrix, but here we have a zero because the resulting set, yeah, this column simply makes that set in the end is zero. And now this really projects onto the image plane, but this has a disadvantage because now distance or depth gets lost. How far are objects away from the camera? If you imagine that here we have another triangle which is in front of that one, yeah? If we project them on the image plane, they are on top of each other. So after projection, we don't know anymore which one was in front of the other. But to be able to maintain that information, what we simply do is that we keep the set coordinate. Yeah? So as a result of the projection, we get a three-dimensional point. X and Y are the image coordinates, and Z tells us how far was that point away from the camera. And And if our box here, or if our viewing, forget about that. Okay, so this gives us, so instead of throwing away Z, we write a one here again. So as a result of our transformation, we project from 3D to 2D, but we get a 3D point. The first two components are the image coordinates, and the last one is the original distance from the camera, which we can use for occlusion later on. Yeah. So the resulting matrix is just the identity matrix. Yeah. So couldn't be simpler. That's for orthogonal. For orthonormal, we already derived this matrix. Yes. Yeah? So you see, the entire difference is just here swapping these two numbers. Yeah, this makes an orthogonal projection to a perspective projection. And now again, we have the problem that by this, yeah, because as a result here, now we get Z over Z equals one. Yeah, so all images end up on the Z equals one plane. So the distance gets lost again, but we can still maintain distance information about the distance using the following trick. We extend the matrix here by a minus one. Now, what does that mean? If we now compute Z before and after, yeah, so let's multiply this with X, Y, Z, one. As a result, for the Z component here, after the mapping, yeah, we get so let's look at the third row. That's how we compute. Let's take the entire matrix. 1, 0, 0, 0, 0, 1, 0, 0, 0, 1, no, no, 0, 0, 1, minus 1, 0, 0, 1, 0. We multiply that with x, y, z, 1. Yeah? Okay. So the new vector has, in top, it has x, then y. And then for z, we have 0 times x plus 0 times y plus z minus 1. So we get z minus 1. And in the bottom row, we have 0 times x, 0 times y plus z plus 0 times 1 delivers a z. And if we dehomogenize, we get x over set, y over set. These are the image coordinates. Yeah, this is perspective, divide by set. And here for the set component, we get set minus 1 over set. And we can also write that as 1 minus 1 over set. So after this mapping now, our points still have a depth value, but this is computed from the original set coordinate in that way. So it's a not linear mapping. So the depth coordinate we get after this mapping, yeah, is not direct, okay, it is directly related, but not linearly. But the nice thing is that this formula here, or this minus one, leads at least to a function where nearby points have a smaller depth than further points. So if it's only about computing occlusion, which is in front of the other, this is as good as a normal set value. Yeah. So we change depth, yeah, but we don't change the order. And so these values here, yeah, can still be used to compute occlusion. But in fact, yeah, this has some impact that we don't have a linear mapping. But the nice thing is we still, yeah, have a very simple matrix. And yeah, okay. Time is up. So we will finish that then on Thursday, and then also speak about how can we use this information about depth and compute occlusion from that, yeah, so that we can not only draw wireframe cubes, but really filled cubes, and so that the front faces are visible and the back faces become invisible. And we will do all that on Thursday. Thank you.